These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The Greek and Persian Wars, Part 2. Lecture 13, Launching a Golden Age.
Welcome back. As we embark together on the second half of our course on the Greek and Persian Wars, we find ourselves in a changed world. Up until the year 466 BC, when Cimon beat in a single day the land forces and the naval forces of the great king there at the Eurymedon River in Asia Minor, up to that time, the Persians had consistently been on the offensive. That goes all the way back to Cyrus taking over the Ionian cities in western Asia Minor, in the old kingdom of Lydia. Following his conquest of Lydia back in the 540s BC, it went on with Darius's attempts to conquer Greece, the Mount Athos invasion, the Marathon campaign, climaxed in Xerxes' first campaign in 480, and then met its end at the Eurymedon River in 466. From now on, Persia will be on the defensive. And to the extent that the Persians involve themselves in trying to weaken the Greeks, they will do so with payments of Persian gold to one side or the other in the hope of turning the Greeks into internal combatants. They, in fact, help sponsor the final phases of the Peloponnesian War between the Spartans and the Athenians, and thus wear down their enemies in a sort of remote control kind of way. But we will no longer see Persian forces on Greek lands. Now, after the Eurymedon River, one might have thought that Cimon was in an unassailably high position. But of course, people like Themistocles had thought that before as Athenian leaders, and they'd been proved to be wrong. The Athenian populace was a very fickle one, and they would quickly turn on leaders if they no longer seemed to be in tune with the times. Let's remember about Cimon that he was a great aristocrat, that he was pro-Spartan, and these two things together put him at odds with the growing tendency in Athens towards desire for a radical democracy. One unintended consequence of his navalization of Athens was the empowerment, the political and economic empowerment of the lower class, that majority of about 20,000 lower-class citizens. They were called thetes, T-H-E-T-E-S. The thetes are the usually landless laborers of Athens. Athens' classes, by the way, were based on income, so that this is the majority sitting at the bottom. Now they want more control over their government. They've already had a democratic assembly where it's one man, one vote, but the agenda for that assembly had been in part shaped by an aristocratic council called the Council of the Areopagus, a sort of Athenian House of Lords. After the Eurymedon River, 4 years after, there was a dramatic democratic revolution staged by a couple of naval heroes, Ephialtes and young Pericles, who've both won their spurs, campaigning with the Athenian Navy in eastern waters, attacking Persian sites. At this point in Athens, it's a credential required of all would-be politicians and leaders that they have been Persian fighters, that they have been out there in the campaigns with the Navy. Ephialtes in chief, Pericles his lieutenant, they stir up the common people to demand full rights in the government. They get rid of that Council of the Areopagus. They break its powers. It's only left with the power of judging homicide cases and cases involving affronts to the sacred olive trees. This is not a very wide span of influence in political affairs for what used to be the sort of prime movers of Athenian policy. So the Areopagus Council has been broken, and the people also say that it's time that others than the nobles, others than the old rich upper class, be able to hold public office. And so the public offices become open to other citizens as well. Well, Cimon opposed this, and he also opposed the hostility of the lower classes to the Spartans. The upper classes of Athens, they formed part of an intercity, I was going to say international, but it's not quite international, but certainly a pan-Hellenic aristocracy that shares the same enjoyment of the Olympic Games, which was definitely a set of gentlemen's sports, of the same poets, worshipped at the same Pan-Hellenic shrines, had guest friends among other aristocratic families in other cities, at times took their spouses from aristocratic families in other cities. The radical Athenian democracy is opposed to all that. For them, it's Athens for the Athenians. They even pass citizenship laws, which say you've got to have an Athenian father and an Athenian mother, which is a terrible blow to rich Athenians like Cimon. Yes, had an Athenian father, but his mother was a Thracian. He would not even have been considered a citizen of Athens if they'd not grandfathered in the living citizens at the time of the change of law. So Cimon, being so out of tune with this new democratic Athens, was exiled in that process called ostracism. And it seemed that the floodgates had opened for aggressive, radical new policies at home and abroad. And Athens launched itself on a series of wars now, sometimes with the League, the Delian League, sometimes without, fighting Spartans, fighting Spartan allies, as well as fighting the great king and his dominions. And shortly after this democratic revolution, which, by the way, the architect, Ephialtes, did not survive. He was assassinated by parties unknown during that revolutionary year of 462-461 BC. Obviously, feelings were running very high about what he had done. Pericles survived. Pericles becomes one of the new leaders of this new democratic Athens. Their greatest campaign was a campaign to, of all places, Egypt. When the fleet of Athens and the Delian League was in Cyprus, either in 460 or 459 BC, just a couple of years after the big democratic revolution, they were approached by envoys sent by a native Egyptian king who said, "We Egyptians are going to rebel against the Persians. We're going to throw out our Persian governors and reclaim the liberty of Egypt. Help us." Now, the Athenians like to view themselves as the people who help those in need. Supplicants who came to Athens asking for help were traditionally given a very warm reception. Lots of their plays, their tragedies, show someone coming as a suppliant to the Athenians and receiving help. As one of my colleagues in the field of classics said, he's a bit of a wit, what an Athenian would always ask himself in these ages was, what would Theseus do? And what Theseus would always do is help the needy, help the oppressed, help people from overseas who came to you needing assistance. So the Athenian generals, led by a fellow named Charitimides, broke off their campaign in Cyprus and led the fleet south across the eastern Mediterranean till the sea turned brown from the sediment of the Nile River pouring out into the Mediterranean from the delta, and they finally saw that long, low, flat line of sandbars and waving palm trees and realized they had reached their goal. And now they have embarked into an extraordinary new world. They enter the mouths of the Nile. The triremes row up the branches of the Nile River. They are surrounded by this world of villages, of endless wheat fields, of nodding palms, everything fresh and fragrant and moist. The Greeks, from their dry, rocky homeland, they'd never experienced anything like that. Some of them, especially the Ionians, knew this area because there had been, as I said, an old Ionian trading city called Naucratis in the delta, where the Egyptians allowed Greeks to come and trade at this Greek-held emporium. I made the comparison to Hong Kong in China, or the Portuguese cities of Goa and Macau in India and China. The same sort of trading center for foreign merchants had brought many of the Ionians there. So there were pilots and there were members of the expeditionary force who knew Egypt already. Nonetheless, for most of the Greeks, it was brand new terrain and a place of marvels. It's extraordinary to think that at the time of annual flood on the Nile, the triremes could row right past the pyramids on the Giza Plateau. They could see the gigantic monuments of the pharaohs in places defaced with graffiti from earlier Ionian mercenaries who'd fought in Egypt in ages past. And there they came to shore, they unloaded their troops from the triremes, they formed an army. A battle was either happening when they arrived or about to between the Persian garrisons who had been detailed to hold Egypt and these rebel Egyptians trying to get their country back into their own hands. the Athenians and the other Greeks joined in the battle and won a tremendous victory. And the Persian survivors fled to the ancient city of Memphis, abandoned most of the city to the Greeks and the Egyptians, but took refuge in a part of the city that the Greeks called the White Fortress or the White Castle. The rest of Egypt was theirs. And as a payment, as a gift for having shared the risks of the rebellion, the new Egyptian king shared the rule of Egypt with Athens for 6 years. Well, we have to realize this also should mean shared the revenues of what had been one of the richest provinces of the Persian Empire. There's no reason to think that the king stopped the payment down on the village level of all the annual tributes. They also had control, probably, of the tribute that came down the Nile River from the interior, from Ethiopia, where the Ethiopians every year were accustomed to send to the great king ebony logs, ivory tusks, other treasures from Central Africa. These would now be flowing into the hands of the new king of Egypt and his Athenian allies. So they established themselves, and probably thought it was forever, as a presence in Egypt, a conquering force that was going to pay itself back for its risks and for its services in this wealth. They took over a little port on the coast of Palestine, a place called Tel Dor, that used to be a Phoenician stronghold, but the Athenians came down upon it, seized that little tell, that little artificial mound of ancient cities stacked one on top of the other that was there by a long lagoon. And from that base, they could reach Egypt in a long day's rowing. They could also get to Cyprus in a long day's rowing. And in this way, they had stepping stone sites, islands, coastal cities, Cyprus, Dor, and then finally Egypt, so that they could routinely get their triremes with single-day hops all the way around the eastern Mediterranean to this new sphere of Athenian influence. Well, what can we see at home that might show that they have started to have the wealth of Egypt pumped into Athens' economy? There are two great projects they undertake at this time. One is to run a line of long walls, a pair of long walls from Athens down to this new city, the Piraeus, their harbor city. So within that corridor of walls is a protected road. No enemy can now cut Athens off from the sea. They are linked to the sea by the long walls and the defended road that runs between the long walls as if by an umbilical cord, and Athens is now proof against sieges and blockade. Well, not blockades at sea, but since they are controlling the sea, they are lords of the sea, nobody can blockade them. They might as well now be on an island as far as being protected against the Spartans or any other enemies on land. That's one thing, and that was a gigantic fortification process because each one of the gigantic long walls is 4.5 miles long. They also put up a sort of Statue of Liberty type bronze image of Athena up on the Acropolis. And this is one of the early works of one of the first generation of Athenian artists of genius, a man named Phidias, who will go on in later life to create one of the official seven wonders of the world, the ivory and gold statue of Zeus at Olympia, site of the Olympic Games. But here at Athens, at the time when Athens was controlling Egypt, he erected on the open rock of the Acropolis a towering statue of Athena in bronze. She was shown holding her spear up, and the spear point rose so high and had a polished tip that when the sun hit the tip of the spear, ships 4.5 miles away out at sea could see the glint of light up there and feel that they were being drawn by the light of the goddess into the harbor at Athens. The Athenians ultimately came to grief in Egypt. The Persians, of course, couldn't afford to lose this province. At least that's what they thought. There are some tacticians who feel that it was always a fault of Persian strategy to think that they needed to hang on to Egypt. In the end, it probably wasn't worth the cost, and it created permanent instability there on their southwestern frontier. At any rate, the Persians are, of course, relentless. They ultimately assembled a large naval and land force. The land force marched through the desert, crossed the Sinai Peninsula and into the northeast corner of Egypt, a place where King Darius's engineers had built a canal, predecessor of the modern Suez Canal, that joined one of the branches of the Nile Delta to the Red Sea. They came back in that way on land. Meanwhile, the Phoenician fleet came along the coast, the Pelusian branch of the Nile River, as the Nile spreads out through the delta in many channels. And they caught, as it was approaching Egypt, a reinforcement fleet of 50 Athenian triremes that knew nothing of the Persian counteroffensive. They had been off guard now for 6 years, ever since the big battle that put Egypt into their hands. And as they entered that branch of the Nile, the Phoenician ships came swarming out from their hiding places, surrounded the Athenian ships, and destroyed them. They then turned their attention to the Greeks in the interior. They were still besieging Memphis for 6 years. The Persians inside that white fortress had been able to hold out. And so now they find themselves with Persians both on the inside of Memphis and a Persian army on the outside. There are some skirmishes. The Athenians are worsted, and they retreat to an island in the Nile Delta with their ships. So they've taken the triremes of the League fleet, thousands of men, maybe still the original 200 ships. It's not clear from the accounts, which in this case are given to us by Thucydides, the historian of Athens and Athens' imperial power. But what happened was there was a place where the Nile branched in two as it headed toward the sea. The Egyptians had long before dug a canal to join those two branches. So there was a triangular wedge of land surrounded completely by water. They brought their triremes to this piece of land. It was called Prosopitis. They drew the triremes up on the shore and they settled down to defend themselves. They defended themselves for a very long time. I said the sea battle happened in the sixth year. In fact, we're not already in the sixth year of their occupation when the war with the Persians began. And they, for a long time, were able to live off this island, which was a big space with farmland and crops and so on. Finally, the Persians put their mind to it. How can we get at them? Now, never forget the Persian genius for engineering and especially hydraulics. They diverted the river so that the canal would be drained of its water. And once the canal was drained of its water, they could send in the horsemen and the infantry straight across the dry bed and hit the Athenians very hard without having to beat ships and carry out an amphibious maneuver. After fighting for a while, the Athenians surrendered. Some had been killed. The rest were allowed to leave Egypt under a truce. They made their way westward into the Sahara Desert. They finally reached the Greek city of Cyrene, up on the Mediterranean coast, and from there, the few that remained were transported back to Athens. That was the end of the attempt to make Egypt a part of the Greek world. But certainly, I can't help but feeling that those Athenians who got home, who had now seen the wonders of pharaonic Egypt, the temple at Luxor, all of those amazing pillared edifices of the pharaohs, and the pyramids and the Sphinx, I just can't help thinking that their eyes were opened to what a great power should look like. They had grown up in a small town, Athens. They had seen that town leveled to be a sort of a ground zero after the Persians burned it and it was reduced to ashes. Now they came home with their heads full of this grandeur of Egypt. And it's going to play out, I think, very quickly in a new Athens that's going to rise on the remnants of the old. Meanwhile, with the defeat of the Athenian expedition to Egypt, which probably happened about 454 BC, and some new campaigns by Cimon, who was back from exile, his 10 years exile of ostracism, back in the saddle in Cyprus, both sides, Athens on the one side, Persia on the other side, both sides had now been battered. Both sides had now been beaten. Both sides had been involved in wars that had stretched for, well, the invasion of Xerxes was in 480. We're now in the 450s, so almost 30 years have gone by, a full generation of fighting. People were starting to think about peace. Now, the Ionians and the other Greeks who were part of the Delian League, they had long ago come to the conclusion that this never-ending war was a bad idea. More and more of them had stopped sending men and ships to the annual campaigns of the Delian League that had been led at first by Cimon, and they began to just pay money, pay an equivalent sum. And as they sent that money to Athens, that tribute, the Athenians cared less and less about the opinions of those people as to the governance of the League and its policies. After all, these people were simply paying for protection. And as long as the Athenians gave it, they felt that they could make all the other decisions. So it was that at the invitation of the Persians conveyed to the Athenians who were campaigning in Cyprus, the great king invited an Athenian, to come to Susa to talk about the peace. Now, in Athens, often you take over the status and the occupation of your family, your forefathers. There was a family called the Charakes, the Herald's family, that were traditionally the heralds of Athens, the people who carried ambassadorial messages to other powers and represented Athens abroad. And the current head of that family was a man named Callias, who was one of the richest men in Athens and was also the brother-in-law of Cimon, the great general. So Callias was sent up the royal road all the way to Susa, that 3 months' journey, and there he negotiated a peace with King Artaxerxes, the son of the Xerxes who'd invaded. The terms of the peace recognized the Athenian sphere of influence, recognized Athens as a power in the world with its own right to its own territory. The king agreed to stay away from the sea in Asia Minor. According to the somewhat contradictory accounts we have of the terms of the peace, no complete text of it has ever been found that was universally regarded as genuine. He agreed that his forces would not come closer to the sea than a 3 days' march on foot or a 1 day ride on horseback. So there's now a Persian-free zone all along the coastal strip that guaranteed the Greek cities in Asia freedom from Persian interference. The Greeks apparently, in turn, agreed not to make war on the king's territories, to give up that everlasting campaign that they had sworn to on Delos. Callias finished his negotiations. He came home with the peace, which had been concluded with the Persians. And he also brought back a gift that the king had made to him personally. Peacocks, the first ones ever known or seen in Europe, were brought back as little trophies, little exotic items, presents from the great king. And Callias very proudly displayed these in his garden there at Athens to anybody who would come and look at them. The clause about giving up the hostility to the great king, if it was in there, and it seems it has to have been, or the Persians wouldn't have agreed to stay away from the coast, that caused some problems for the Athenians. The justification for the Delian League had been, we will wage war forever against Persia. Now, we're not sure that they swore that they would stop fighting, but we do know that now there were limits set to this Persian expansion, and we assume they were limits to the Athenians going in the other way. One is down south near the Eurymedon River at some islands called the Caledonian Rocks. The other is up at the Bosphorus, the Black Sea end of the Bosphorus near Byzantium. Those are sort of the limits beyond which the great king cannot pass, but by extension, they must be the limits beyond which the Athenians will not invade. What then is the justification for keeping the alliance together? What's the justification for compelling all those cities and islands to keep making their annual payments to the Delian League treasury, which has by now been in fact moved to Athens? Well, Pericles is the man who comes forward apparently and states the reason. He said, eternal vigilance will be the price of our freedom. You must never stop paying to maintain this navy. Navies must be kept up through tremendous annual investment of money. And without our navy, the Persians will be back in an instant. So the money can't stop. The allies cannot stop paying. We may not be at war today, but unless we are always ready, as we transform, as we would say, our Department of War into a Department of Defense, nonetheless, it's going to cost us just as much. And the payments will not be reduced. Well, at this point, with almost all of the 150 allies paying money, with only three big islands up against the coast of Asia Minor, Samos in the south, Chios or Chios in the middle, and Lesbos in the north, still having navies of their own and contributing ships, it's very hard to tell the difference between the Athenian realm on the one side, with this imperial capital of Athens gathering the money from the allies, and the Persian Empire on the other side, with the king gathering annual tribute from his satrapies. Athens shows us the anomaly, in some ways a very terrible anomaly, of a very positive, very democratic city that has fought for freedom and democratic principles at home, but somehow through force of circumstances and through its own ambitions to keep the world free, has become a very oppressive imperialistic power abroad. Now there are revolts in the Delian League. people trying to rebel and get out from under Athenian overlordship, just as in the Persian Empire there had been revolts by people like the Ionians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, who wanted to free themselves from the Persians. And this will be a dark side of the Athenian world for generations to come, this feeling that they are empire builders and that freedom was their banner at the beginning, but now domination is what they are really after. Nonetheless, the Athenians took advantage of this cessation of hostilities against Persia and this continued income from the allies to launch what we've come to call the Golden Age. One of the visions that Pericles had was of transforming Athens into a great imperial capital. So with his friend Phidias, that great sculptor and artist, and with some architects of genius who had grown up in Athens, they decided to create for Athens the most beautiful set of public buildings in Greece. They would be temples, not just the one set on the Acropolis in the heart of Athens, but a rebuilding of the temple at Sunion, the cape where Poseidon was worshipped, or at a place called Rhamnus to the goddess Nemesis, or at Eleusis to the goddesses Demeter and Persephone, who were in charge of the Eleusinian mysteries. All of these places in Attica would get brand new temples. They had taken an oath at the end of the Persian Wars that they wouldn't rebuild the temples destroyed by the Persians. They would remain as burnt testimony to the barbarism of that barbarian horde, the Persian horde, who came in and sacked Athens and burned Greece. But now they didn't want to live with these shattered hulks anymore, and so they put up the most beautiful temples that the Greek world had ever known. And the Parthenon itself, sacred to Athena, Parthenos, Athena the maiden, was the centerpiece of this whole Periclean building program. It was the temple of the greatest architectural refinement. It looks like a perfect sort of geometrical prism, a perfect set of rectangular forms with this triangular gabled roof, but in fact, there's scarcely a straight line in it. It's all curves and tosses of the columns, tremendous sophistication in the architecture to give the illusion of a temple almost lighter than air floating there on top of that rock. It was a controversial temple. The people in Athens themselves, some of the aristocrats who were Pericles' opponents, said, "You're decking out our city like a pretentious woman. We are not happy to see you divert the money from our naval allies away from defense and put it into these buildings only for the glorification of Athens and yourself." And Pericles is said to have responded, "The money does not belong to those who give, but to those who receive. As long as we provide them with the defense against Persia that they have been guaranteed, we are free to do as we will with the rest of the money." The Parthenon was itself in part a bank where the money was piled up from the tribute and guarded by the goddess herself. Her great statue inside the temple, which was of ivory for the face and the hands, and of gold sheets over a wooden core for the rest of her body, was made so that the gold could be pulled off and melted down in case of a national emergency. That's no way to treat a goddess and her dress. But it became the centerpiece of a great cult of Athena that had its celebration each year at midsummer. The early days of the month of Hecatombeon, the Athenian New Year, and its first month began at midsummer. That was the great feast of Athena. Hecatombeon means the month when you sacrifice 100. They sacrificed 100 oxen to Athena up on the summit of the Acropolis. So in this golden age that is going to see Athens getting its philosophical schools and being the great center in the world for drama and staging of new plays, tragedy and comedy, and sciences flourishing, and new inquiry in all sorts of fields. The centerpiece each year was a great parade, a procession, where all the people of Athens, resident aliens, commoners, old aristocrats, got together and paraded through the streets of Athens, carrying offerings up to Athena on her rock. The young girls of Athens, a few select ones, had been laboring for a year to weave and embroider a new robe, a peplos, for the statue of Athena. The goddess got a new dress every year, and the old one was put reverently away. How did they carry that through the streets and the procession, that new robe? Well, they had become now a city of the sea. So they had a little ship on wheels. The mast of that ship and its yardarm carried not an ordinary sail, but the peplos itself, the robe of the goddess, to symbolize that in this sail of the ship, we are seeing Athena as the protectress of our great naval enterprise that has beaten the Persians and made us a city, a free city that can look across the water at the great king eye to eye. And so that ship on wheels was trundled through the streets when it got to the bottom of the Acropolis slope. The sail was taken down, reverently folded, carried up to the Acropolis, and placed on the statue of Athena as her new garment for the next year. In this great ceremony, the Athenians found the climax of their golden age, an age that had unified the population, an age dedicated to the arts, to creating the beautiful, and above all, to holding up Athens as, in Pericles' words, the school of Greece, the place that taught people how to live. We sometimes have the illusion in our history books that this was all a matter of pure intellect, of people in ivory towers thinking deep thoughts and creating wonderful artistic works, but it wasn't. It was the fruit of a war. It was the fruit of victories fought by a population of this city of Athens that had given up so much and deferred so much of their rewards to reach a point where they could rival any other city on earth as the greatest market in the Mediterranean and as the most beautiful city in the entire Greek world.